So this evening, I'm going to do one of the things that they kind of teach you not to do in seminary when you preach. And that is, I'm going to start layering things on until we all just get lost. And there's a reason for that eventually, I hope. But we're going to start with Paul and his writing in 1 Corinthians. Now, this idea is sometimes surprising to people, and that makes sense. It's not immediately obvious. But if you were to look for the earliest references or writing about something like Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper, and actually even the resurrection of Jesus, you would not look to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the stories of Jesus' life. Those were actually written much later. And in fact, the earliest references to communion and to Jesus' resurrection come from the writings of Paul. He wrote early. The Gospels were written later. Now, apparently, somebody talked to Paul, because he obviously wasn't there. In 1 Corinthians 11, he says, "I received from the Lord." It's not clear to me, or anybody for that matter, if he's saying that, well, Jesus just like opened up the sky again and told him, or if it's just Peter heard from Jesus because he was sitting right there and then told Paul at some point, because we know that they knew each other. They knew each other well enough to get into an argument, interestingly enough. I tend to think it was that. Peter just told Paul. But let's appreciate just how weird it is for the earliest reference to Holy Communion to be written to a group of followers of Jesus in the city of Corinth. The whole thing started with Jesus in Galilee. Think of a real backwoods area of the country. I have to be careful sometimes because I'll say a place and people will say, well, I'm from there. It's like, sorry. It's still terrible, but I'm sorry. Galilee was uneducated. Well, that was the stereotype. It turns out they were a little better than that. But Galilee was just an area that the Roman world didn't really think about unless there was an insurrection. And that actually happened from time to time. But this teacher, prophet, healer, miracle worker, Jesus, from a relatively newly founded city called Nazareth, started gathering a following. And from the moment he started, it's either 1 or 3 years or somewhere in between, that he made his way down to Jerusalem. And it was there that he brought his friends. They celebrated Passover, and Paul recounts for the first time in history what happened. That before he was betrayed, in the middle of the meal, he takes bread, and then he gets weird with it. He says, "This is my body, and this is my blood of the new covenant shed for you." What a weird way to engage in dinner conversation. I don't know if maybe it's God. what a weird dinner conversation. And obviously it left an impression because we're still talking about it. But that all happened in a very among a very small group of Jewish men, most likely just the men, at least as best we can tell. And it happened in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is a very long way from Corinth. And within 20 or so years, you have a Jewish man writing to a group of Greek people in the San Francisco of the Greek world, Corinth, explaining to them yet again a very weird conversation that a Jewish nobody had during a Jewish holiday that frankly only really makes sense in a Jewish context in Jerusalem. In 20 years, a bunch of Greeks are doing the same. in historical terms, that is like lightning. And in fact, it's actually very difficult to explain how something like that spread to such a weird and different group of people without eventually coming to terms with the fact that, oh, that tomb was empty. But nevertheless, Paul is writing and he explains. This man was betrayed. But before that happened, and he went to his grave, he gave this meal. Bread, it's his body, wine, and his blood. Now, one of the things that tells us, if we're going to think from maybe a historical standpoint, is that from the earliest moments of this Jesus movement, followers gathering around bread and wine was absolutely critical and central to whatever it means to follow Jesus. And really, for our 2,000-year history, you get a lot of diversity, shall we say. Sometimes it gets weird. Sometimes, usually it's kind of contained. But throughout our 2,000-year history, that is one of the consistent things. That regardless of the change in evolving beliefs about communion, we still do it. That's one layer. Because that idea was so central and so obvious to whatever it meant at that time to follow Jesus, when John is writing his gospel, he is able to make some assumptions about those who are either reading it or hearing it read. Now, one more dating data point, and no, I don't mean like as a precursor to engagement. It's not funny, but whatever. John was written last. That's almost universally accepted. And that means that John can assume that his readers know one of those, most likely it's Mark. And we can tell that for a couple of reasons. And one of them is actually in our reading from the book of John tonight. Where did John mention the Lord's Supper in our reading? He doesn't. He skips right over it. And the only way you can really reconcile him skipping over something that is obviously central to following Jesus is that he can just make the assumption that his readers already know. We do this every now and again in modern life. If I went to a baseball game to cheer on whatever team, I don't know, the Isotopes, why not? And the Isotopes were just getting crushed. And I told you about the game and said, yeah, I just left at the seventh inning stretch because whatever. I can assume you know what that means, that it's a break in play. Everyone gets up and stands and sings, which is weird in our culture. We only do that at baseball games and church. but I don't need to explain what that is. You just know. John is doing the same thing. And as John gets to this moment, you get a sense that he's been building to it. Because he spends half of his telling of Jesus' life, more or less, in just the final days of Jesus' life. He slows the pace down. Jesus doesn't give a lot of teaching. They don't have a long conversation. That comes a couple chapters later. But it's like in a movie when there's a whole lot of action and really important dialogue and it all builds up and then suddenly the director just slows the pace down and zooms in on just a few people as they kind of digest everything that's happened and is going to happen. That's this moment. He gives us the information that the man who's going to stab himself in the, or stab Jesus rather, in the back, is sitting at that table. It's unclear how much or how involved Judas was, but I think it's at least clear to me that when Jesus broke that bread and passed the cup of wine, Judas was there. Can you imagine? And here's the next layer. Jesus knows what the fallout is for what Judas is about to do. And there's real strong evidence that Judas has no idea. Because when Judas sees that Jesus is not stopping this train once it's left the station, he just comes apart. How much fortitude do you need to serve the person who's going to betray you while you know how devastating those consequences are going to be, and they have no idea? So at some point, Jesus, again, gets really weird, and he takes the bread and breaks it. And I mean, if I had you over to my house for dinner, and I took out some bread and broke it, and then said, "This is my body," if I was being serious and not just being utterly blasphemous, you would think I'm having some problems. And you would be justified in thinking that. But Jesus does. And then Jesus just gets weirder. He gets up, takes off his outer garment. You usually wear two layers in that culture, and takes a towel and a container of water and says to his friends, "All right, give me your feet." That's strange. In that culture, it's really only servants who do that, not the teacher, not the one who has gathered everybody together. And Peter picks up on this right away. He says, "You're going to wash my feet?" Jesus said, "Yeah." And honestly, Peter's not wrong in saying, "No, you'll never wash my feet. That's so beneath you." And then, of course, Jesus continues and says, "Yeah, but if I don't do this, you don't get it. You don't get to be a part of this." And then Peter, of course, being Peter, very much an all-or-nothing guy, open mouth, insert foot here type, he says, "Whoa, well, then wash everything." Calm down, Peter. Just the feet. Now, the fact that Jesus says, "You'll understand this later," leads us to the conclusion that what Jesus is ultimately talking about is the washing of baptism. And it's going to be a while before they really get that. And maybe it's John's intention. This part's not quite as clear, but to me anyway, but maybe it's John's intention, thinking that his readers are going to know that this is when Jesus gave us his body and blood. It's time to include the other way that God brings us the grace won by Jesus, in baptism. But again, that's weird. To just get up and start washing your dinner guest's feet. If I come to your house for dinner, please don't touch my feet. In fact, that's just a good rule. Don't touch my feet. The only time you can touch my feet is if we're doing jujitsu, and then you're trying to break my foot. And for some reason, that feels less vulnerable to me. I think I'm just used to that. Otherwise, it's uncomfortable. Did Jesus wash Judas's feet? If he was there, yeah. So there's another layer. How does Jesus take the literal action of a servant with a basin of water, washing the feet of the guy who's going to stab him in the back, again, unaware of the devastating consequences that will result. How do you do that? I have no idea. Jesus then continues. He goes back to eating, I guess. And he continues to prod his disciples. And in typical John fashion, he says a couple of things that take a while to digest, and we're not going to do that tonight. But then he says, I'm leaving. Told you I was going to. You can't come where I'm going. And in 24 hours, they're really not going to want to. And then he says, this is how everyone's going to know who you are. You love each other. I think for a church body like ours, the Lutheran Church, that has since its inception very heavily emphasizing theology, this one sometimes is easy to miss. When I was in grad school, the second time, one of my classmates was a Baptist, and he said, you know what, man, you Missouri Synod guys, you know, I've known a couple of you, and you're all really smart. Y'all know a lot. I was like, whatever. Well, you should see some of my classmates. And that really got me thinking. I don't know if that's how we want to be known. I mean, which would be better at your funeral? If everyone said, wow, he was really smart. He read a lot of books. Wow, he really knew how to love. I know which one Jesus is going to recommend. But that becomes the marker. And for 2,000 years, we've struggled. And sometimes we've done okay. Sometimes it's been harder to love each other. And for 20 or so years after Jesus has this moment, this final moment with his friends, you have a group on what might as well be the other side of the world, across the Mediterranean, in the wild and weird city of Corinth, struggling to come together because nobody has ever, in their culture, ever tried to do something like this, gather people together to love each other and continue to share a very special meal together that witnesses to and brings to them the love that binds them. Never been done. And so, hopefully by now, it would be really hard for you to backtrack everything we've said. I hope you get a sense of just how heavy and multi-layered and just intense this moment really is. There's so many things that happen so quickly with so little action. But in that moment, without even having to explain it, John has given us this glimpse of Jesus coming to us. His body, it's broken. His blood, it's spilt for you and for me. When the reality is we probably have more in common with Judas. And that this cleansing that Jesus wins for us, this forgiveness, this new start, what we'll eventually call grace and mercy, begins with Jesus doing the last thing that he should, which is washing the feet of his students. And Peter, of course, missing the point. And I feel like we often have more in common with Peter than anybody else in the room. In that sense. And then from there, already knowing how things are going to play out, and it's not in our reading, it kind of skips over it. Jesus goes up to Judas and says, what you're going to do, do it quickly. And then he left. And the train has effectively left the station. There's no stopping it shortly after that. And when that train comes to that conclusion, as Jesus breathes his last, he starts pulling together the broken bread, the spilled wine, the washed feet. And then it waits. And then when that tomb is empty, suddenly all of those things actually have meaning. But we begin tonight just with the bread and the wine. Amen. Please rise as you are able.